Hi, my name's Josh Bollinger. I'm the Communications Coordinator for the Harry R. Hughes Center for Agroecology, a nonprofit organization affiliated with the University of Maryland College of Agriculture and Natural Resources. I'd like to introduce you to SALT, the podcast, a limited three-episode series that's looking into the environmental phenomenon known as saltwater intrusion that's occurring on the Delmarva Peninsula, a stretch of rural land in the Mid-Atlantic on the East Coast that covers a portion of Delaware, Maryland, and Virginia. My organization is partnering with several others, including the University of Maryland College of Ag and its agroecology lab, the George Washington University, and the University of Delaware on a National Fish and Wildlife Foundation grant looking at saltwater intrusion and finding viable solutions for the farming community that's experiencing issues as a result of what Dr. Kate Tully with the agroecology lab describes as invisible flood. So join me as we talk to some of the researchers who we're working with and get an inside look at just what is saltwater intrusion, what's causing it, and what it's doing to our lands and crops, and how we can adapt. So why don't we introduce ourselves? Kate, why don't you start?
Hello, I'm Kate Tully, and I am an associate professor of agroecology in the Department of Plant Science and Landscape Architecture at the University of Maryland.
And I am Brian Moyer. I'm Kate's field and lab technician here in the agroecology lab at University of Maryland.
Great. Thanks for joining me today. What I wanted to start off with for this series was frame the topic of saltwater intrusion, get at why you're interested in this research, why you started it, you know, et cetera. So I guess to begin, I've personally been hearing a lot more about saltwater intrusion in the past several years. But everybody might not know what it is. Can you go over and just first give a general explanation of what saltwater intrusion is and what it does? How does it work?
Sure. Saltwater intrusion is the landward movement of sea salts, and it happens in advance of sea level rise. So where you might see the mean high water rising, as we talk about things like climate change and global sea level rise, saltwater intrusion actually happens before that. And it's difficult to see, so our lab calls it the invisible flood, because you see these symptoms of saltwater intrusion popping up all over these low-lying coastal areas. But usually by the time you start to see that, it means that saltwater intrusion has already really damaged some of those areas.
So then what's happening in general in these low-lying coastal areas? Can you tell me about the areas that you're studying and what's going on in the landscapes there?
Sure. So our research is focusing on the Delmarva Peninsula, which is Delaware, Maryland, and Virginia, and the eastern shores of those three regions. And in that area, global sea level rise rates are four times the global average in that region. And it's incredibly low-lying. A lot of these lands and these farms are basically at sea level, which means that as soon as those seas start to rise and as soon as those salts start moving inland, these fields and also forests are affected by that.
So in terms of what's it do for the farmers working on the land there, for instance?
Well, and Brian can talk about this too, but we see a lot of damage done to crops, specifically the typical crops that we see down there. So corn and soybean don't do very well. Farmers are starting to switch to things like sorghum, and that's because it's a low input crop and it does okay in the saltwater intruded areas. And in many cases, unfortunately, farmers will just start to abandon their properties.
Have you seen that happening in real time?
Oh, yes. Right, yeah. Brian?
We've witnessed it. We have at least two farmers that I can think of that we work with, Betty and Wendell. Both of them have been having serious issues with farms. Betty's farm is out of commission now. We started there 5 years ago, and it was an active farm then. and just over time, it's just not profitable.
That was one of the questions I wanted to ask is, when did you start this research? And two, it's now December 2023. How big of a difference are you seeing since that time period in the areas where you've been working?
Well, I'll start with the origin story, and then I'll let Brian also talk about it. But the origin story is kind of fun. It was basically two friends sitting down over a cup of coffee looking at Google Earth. So Karen and I sort of sat down, and
Karen
Gadan, who is an associate professor at the George Washington University. At that time, she was here at the University of Maryland, and we were just two pals looking at a map together, and she was studying ghost forests and showed me where she was working. And I was a new faculty member looking for projects, and we zoomed out, and I said, that farm that's right next to that forest has some white stuff on the edges of the field. I wonder if that could actually be salt damage. And she said, maybe it could. And we called the local soil conservation district office manager down there, and he took us for a drive, and that's what it was. It was salt-damaged fields, and at that point, no one had been studying this in the Delmarva region. Very few people.
Has it been studied elsewhere?
The major area where we see it is in the Carolinas. We have seen some people doing research. The problems are different, but that's where the other research that we know of, particularly on ag lands. There's not as much work on ag lands.
Is it still sort of a recent development on this? How long maybe in the Carolinas have they known about that? Do you know?
I feel like the work started probably in the early 2000s.
So it is recent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that we had trouble finding funding for a while for this work because people didn't think it was a problem. It wasn't showing up on people's radar. But Brian can talk about how things have changed in the last couple of years.
Yeah, so Brian, what do you do? How do you work with Kate in her lab, and what do you do, and what are you seeing?
So I do a lot of the field role. So that's out collecting samples and meeting with farmers. The communities that we've seen down there, we do see, less and less farmers every year. We're talking to farmers. Most of them are older people that are trying to get out. There's not an influx of newer farmers. There's not the economic perspective there for them to, there's no incentive for them to come in and start farming. The people who are still farming are basically doing it because it's what they've been doing for a long time. And not that there aren't successful farmers down there, but there are definitely people that are suffering as well.
Well, I mean, it's the career they chose. They've grown up in it. Well, most
it's
of the time,
they know.
It's what they do. I'd have a hard time trying to do something else too. So I can definitely understand that.
It's also expensive to get out of farming,
right?
Like the equipment's so expensive. It's like you've sunk a lot.
And you're in debt.
Yeah, you're a lot of capital into those pieces of equipment, and then they're now too heavy to roll over the field, and that's a real pickle.
So how did you get interested, Brian, in this research? How long have you been working with Kate?
So I've been with the lab since May of 2020, I believe it was, that I joined. I had recently moved back from Costa Rica. I was living abroad for a few years, and I found Kate's lab, and I had actually applied for the lab technician position, which I knew at the time whenever I applied that I wasn't exactly qualified for. I had a great interview with Kate. There was another prospective person that was selected because they were actually qualified for the role. But Kate told me, hey, you're probably more qualified for a field technician role, and I'll be interviewing for one of those in the spring. She re-interviewed me. I came on board, and since then I've actually overtaken the lab role as well. So I'm fully integrated in the lab. It's been like 3 years now, 2.5 years.
One of the best hiring decisions I've ever made in my life was hiring Brian.
Well, I know that you work so backstory here is I work for the Hughes Center for Agroecology. We work with Dr. Tully's lab on this grant. And in the summertime, we host an internship program with them. But they also have an internship program of their own. And anyway, usually each summer, you have interns from not just the University of Maryland, but other colleges and institutions. They get together and they all work on this problem together, and they do actual field work, they do actual research in in the field and in a lab. And Brian, you're there with them every step of the way. I like your introduction every year in the intro to the internship at the beginning of the summer. You say they get buggy, muddy, and muggy, or whatever you say.
Yeah,
Just to give it all out there, this is going to be actual hard work.
and every year the interns impress me. They're always a bright bunch of students. They're always hardworking with minimal complaints. And yeah, it's not the most enjoyable being out there in the middle of summer, in the middle of a field, in the sun, hot and sweaty, you know, digging in the soil. But they do it and it's rewarding. And then we come back and we do sit in the air conditioned lab and process samples. So I would say that's the nice thing, is that we do have a good balance of, you know, field and lab work that helps counteract each other.
Sure. I'm painting this picture that it's grueling. You're building the pyramids out there or something, but it's not.
Yeah.
Can feel like that sometimes.
We do deal with bugs. We do deal with heat exhaustion sometimes. And so it's just, you know, being prepared for them, but it's also the same environment that the farmers are out there in.
That's true. And yeah, right. All the time.
Yeah.
So let's go back to my question, I guess. First, Kate, why did you decide, you know, you've sort of carved a little area for yourself here in saltwater intrusion. You told your origin story of how it's come about, but you've stuck with it, you know, and I'm assuming you're going to continue to investigate this issue. So, you know, what interests you so much about it, and why are you continuing down this path?
Well, the even, you know, further backstory is that I love working with farmers. And I think that my whole career, that's all I've done. I actually worked with smallholder farmers in Costa Rica. And then after that, I worked with smallholder farmers in Kenya and Tanzania. And my research has always been really closely tied to what are some of the major issues that farmers are facing, and then what kind of research can I do, can my team do, to help try to bring some solutions to bear on those issues. And so I really like to think of my work as being driven by farmer questions. And I was looking for a project like that when I came to the University of Maryland, and this one really appealed to me because it's also in an area where that's relatively underserved. It's an area where we have some of the lowest income people in all of Maryland, and their voices are not always heard, and that means that the issues that they face may not be at the top of everybody's mind. And so I was just really compelled by that. And the other part of it is that there is just an emotional part, I think, to this work, because we talk about how our history is going underwater, our history is drowning, and that history is good, bad, and ugly. The Eastern Shore has a legacy of issues, slavery, and other, you know, issues related to social justice. But all of that's going underwater. We're losing it. Churches are going underwater. And that legacy is being lost, as Brian was saying. There isn't an influx of young farmers coming into the region. And so there's a big question, like, what's this area going to look like in the next 30 years?
And like Kate was just saying, it's not just the farmers that we're losing. We're missing the fishermen now. We're missing the clergy. We're missing it's whole communities that are disappearing as well.
So we haven't really explained what specifically you're researching in this field. So or what you hope to come from the research, I suppose, is the better question, right?
Right.
So why don't we discuss that?
Sure. So the projects that I'm involved in are trying to better understand what is happening in agroecosystems that are affected by saltwater intrusion and sea level rise. And specifically, our lab looks at that from a perspective of how can we manage particularly agricultural lands, these agroecosystems, in the face of those issues. So, does that mean planting an alternative crop that might be able to maintain productivity? Does that mean planting a biofuel crop that's totally different? Maybe it's being used as feedstock for anaerobic digestion. Does that mean enrolling in a wetland restoration program and converting your field to a wetland? or putting it in an impoundment. There's all sorts of things that farmers are doing, and we're trying to understand what are the suite of options available to landowners and farmers, and then what are some of the impacts, the environmental impacts that we might see as a result of those decisions.
And I know that when the Hughes Center first got involved in this, alternative crops was like one of the big questions. So have there been, in terms of crops that farmers in that area already grow, is there hope? Not hope. I guess you have to figure in alternative crops, markets for that and whatnot. You're considering all this, I'm assuming.
Right? We are. And I would say that corn and soy are not doing very well. There are parts of the field that can do okay. We talk about how farmers are fighting for inches. So the difference of 2 inches or 4 inches on a field really does mean the difference between you having a crop that year and not. So in some years, farmers can actually do okay on parts of their fields growing corn and soy. But the long term overall, what we're seeing is a sort of degradation and reduction in yields. And we were on a farm not that long ago. Brian, you can talk a little bit about what you saw on that field.
Yeah, I mean, there's Phragmites, which is a marsh species growing literally in the middle of the field because it's now an environment that's favorable to the Phragmites way more so than the corn.
Yeah.
So the alternative for the farmer is, I guess that's what we were sort of discussing that before this. What's the alternative?
Sure. So, I mean, the word alternative was, okay, let's try to look at maybe a salt-tolerant soybean and then a sorghum and maybe barley as crops that would fit kind of naturally into the rotation that farmers are used to. And we had moderate success, I would just say. The salt-tolerant soybean was developed for the Dakotas. So it was a chloride-excluding soybean. That's what's been developed currently and that you can buy on the market. And it's not meant to be grown in a puddle, which is what it's trying to be grown in, a salty puddle. And neither is corn. Corn's not made. In a lot of cases, what's killing the crops is not just the salt. It's actually how wet the fields are. Barley also we had sort of minimal success. I would say that some things that we found that were kind of interesting is part of the reason why those crops didn't do well also is because there's so much pressure now as we lose the marshes. All of the wildlife is moving into the farms. And then they see, oh, sorghum, yum, birdseed, I'm going to eat that. And then the deer bed down in the fields, and then they eat the corn. So the issues, sometimes I'll talk to a farmer and they'll say, oh, well, I don't have problems with saltwater intrusion. I have problems with deer and bird damage. And Brian and I know that that's one and the same, because the reason why we have this increase in pressure from these pests is because we've lost their home range, right? So now they're looking for someplace else to eat.
I never considered that. And I always hear the ag community in the Lower Shore talk about deer damage specifically from sika deer.
Yes, right? From sika deer. And they love the marsh. That's where they used to hang out. And now as the marshes are moving in, they are also moving in.
Wow. So to go back to one of the questions I had was, you see environmental changes very slowly generally, right? But compared to when you started this research to what you're seeing on the ground now, I mean, does it compare?
Well, I'll start, but then I want to kick it over to Brian because he's in the field all the time. But I would just say each year, I think about Betty's farm. Each year, that marsh has moved further and further into that field. And we know that because we stuck a bunch of PVC pipe. And that was our edge of field marker, right? Mm-hmm. And now it's not. It's like that's where the frag is. So I feel it as if we're seeing some of it in real time.
Absolutely. This land-sea boundary is one of the fastest changing ones, one of the most dynamic ones. And we're, like I said, I've been on the project for 3 years. This project at Betty's has been 5 years, and we've definitely seen transition from in those past 5 years, which is rapid. Normally, you wouldn't see this over hundreds of years.
I guess that my question then goes to, I know that the state is trying to have like local governments create a community response around this. Is there, are you seeing some sort of community response around this? I mean, in terms of either within the academic sector?
I think that among farmers, I haven't seen farmers banding together in any kind of grassroots kind of way to sort of address, bring attention and awareness to saltwater intrusion. And there's a couple reasons for that that we can talk about later. But I do think the academic community is starting to understand how important it is. And I would also say that Maryland as a state is actually quite progressive and thinks about these environmental challenges. And they are trying to work towards state-level policies that would help farmers with who are dealing with saltwater intrusion, because there are no programs in existence currently that are tailored to saltwater intrusion. That it could, you know, you could enroll in EQIP, the Environmental Quality Incentives Program, which is part of the sort of the federal programs, as an herbaceous buffer, but the plants that you would plant that would qualify wouldn't grow there. Or the maintenance that would be required, oh, you need to make sure you keep out all of the invasive species. Well, good luck trying to keep Phragmites out. Or you're not allowed to mow. Well, there goes all your Phragmites. So there's no program that is specifically tailored to these systems. And so Maryland is looking to develop that. And then also NGOs. So then the Nature Conservancy is actually also working to try to come up with these coastal resiliency management plans.
So there has been some sort of increased awareness among non-sciencey folk about this, I suppose.
I would agree with that. There's definitely, I mean, my family knows what saltwater intrusion is. It's a much bigger buzzword now, so people are at least aware of what the issue is. It also affects other things like coral reefs. I heard a thing talking the other day that they were talking about using salty water to fight, like saltwater intruded water to fight fires, and how you couldn't do that because then you're basically poisoning the land by bringing that salt up and putting it on the land.
Yeah. So what's causing this phenomenon that we're seeing?
Saltwater intrusion has a couple different causes. Of course, one of them is sea level rise and just the change in relative elevation of the land to the water as our seas are increasing in height across the world. Also, the increased frequency of storms, big, like if you think of Superstorm Sandy, big tides, also drought, and we see those all over the world, and also the connectivity of our landscape. So the fact that on the eastern shore, it's just this really sinuous peninsula of water. We have water that can get really reach pretty far inland, and then pumping of groundwater for things like irrigation or drinking water. And that's when we start to hear about saltwater intrusion also in the news, because sometimes when it really gets people's attention is when you can no longer drink your water because the salt has moved into the drinking water wells.
So what do you plan moving forward? How do you plan to evolve? How does this, you see that your research evolving? You know, I've noticed personally that it's, you know, like I said, you sort of started at like, what are some alternatives you can do here? But then more bits and pieces keep getting added to it, and it's turning into a living sort of breathing project that you come up with paper after paper, and it adds to it. So what's the next thing you're going to add to this research?
Two things come to mind. The first is, I think we're all just really interested in how do we manage these landscapes more broadly. So not just is this crop going to live or die, but how can we manage the system or a whole, not just a field, but a whole farm, which is a lot of fields in combination, and maybe also a waterway. And so this is where I'm really interested in working with policymakers to try to come up with policy tools that would allow farmers, landowners who have lands that are affected by saltwater intrusion, and coming up with really clear management plans that protect the farmer's bottom line, but also the environment.
So, okay, is there an example of what that could be?
So there's not great. I mean, there's some examples actually from out on in like California where people have started to think about how climate change is going to affect these lands. One of the things that you have to sort of change your thinking about is that when we protect and conserve land, we want to keep that land exactly how it was. That's what we think of when we think of national park systems, right? It's to protect and preserve and to keep things the same. This land is changing. So in that policy framework, in your understanding of what a management plan looks like, is the land is changing. At some point, this part of the property will be underwater. And that is we don't have a really good framework for how to manage that. Mm-hmm. Does that mean it's no longer your land? Did you just lose acres? Or does your property, as when you sort of agreed to that management plan, stay the same, even though now you have 5 acres less because 5 acres is actually underwater? And these are the questions that people are wrestling with when they're starting to try to create these management plans.
Before I wrap up, is there any last thing you want to talk about? I know that, this is not just work through the University of Maryland, like you said, but there's institutions throughout the region collaborating with you. I mean, do you want to discuss them real quick, who they are, and, you know, future episodes? This is part one. Future episodes, we'll get to know them a little bit better. But where did all these collaborators come from all of a sudden?
Yeah. We have partners all over the Delmarva, so Delaware, Maryland, and Virginia, and we've been working, and then beyond. I think we've been working closely with different universities, so University of Delaware, University of Virginia Institute of Marine Sciences, and also the George Washington University, which I mentioned, are some of our like core partners. We work with University of Maryland Extension, the Soil Conservation District Office, the Nature Conservancy, Maryland Department of Ag, DNR, the Department of Natural Resources, and the list goes on and on and on. The Hughes Center, of course. And I think that I think all of us just see that this is a problem that cannot be tackled unless you have a lot of really, energetic and excited people working on it. And so we're kind of in the more the merrier kind of scientific approach.
Yeah. Well, I think that wraps it up for us for this first episode. Thanks for both joining me, and have a good one. Talk to you later.
All right.